chapter 11, Yudalet, Vayihi Ha'om Kemisonenim Rabbi Hashem. 11, Yudalet. The 50 parshas that
in the beginning. All you told us about was the report from Halajna.
Right. Now the nun hafuch. You know what Rashi says? What the nun hafuch means? You have to turn the order. 50 parshas back really belongs to 50 parshas back. But he put it here, right? As a separation, you know that there is an opinion in the Gemara that this is a safer bitnei atmo, right? Didn't we mention that? I'm not sure. We didn't mention that.
No, I missed that.
You know, there is an opinion in the Gemara that there is no chamisha chumshei Torah, but shiva chumshei Torah. That's chumshei anymore, right? Where is the Gemara? I don't know. But here, it's on this spot in the Yalkut Shimoni. You know, the Yalkut Shimoni gathers all the Gemaras that talk about the Yalkut Shimoni on this spot says that there is a Mandei Omer that says that this Tuksukim is a safer Bifnei Atzmo. Can you imagine? Breishis Mois Vayikro Bamidbor Til here Vayibin Soya Ronim Nuvnucho Yomar. It's a safer by itself. And then the rest of Bamidbar, and then Dvorim. There are seven books of the Torah. Seven.
He made Bamidbar into three.
And Bamidbar becomes three.
Four after the twin.
Right. So that's what it means. Meaning, and Rashi says that the reason why it is that way. Loimar she'ein ze mekoymoy. Really, chronologically, this is not where it belongs. To differentiate between the Jews leaving Sinai, that's how if you take a look in the Ramban, the Sifsei Chachomim says the Jews leaving Sinai with a sigh of relief. You know that the Jews left Mount Sinai with a sigh of relief. That's what the Gemara says, Ketinoik aboireach mebeit ha-sefer, like a child running away from school. This is the way the Jews felt after Mount Sinai. And the following one, which we are going to see, the man, the misonanim, and vayibin se'aron, like separate the two. Kedei lehavtik ben poronios leporonios, kedei iso, that's the Gemara in Shabbos. This brings down the Gemara in Shabbos, Shabbos Kufuzai. Now, what is the meaning of it? Now, that's what I meant to say, that Reb Chaim Volozhiner learned the first pasuk as the pasuk of the Golus. What does the second pasuk mean? Uvnucho Yomar. Uvnucho Yomar. What did Moshe Rabbeinu say when the Oron would settle with the rest? Uvnucho. Shuvo Hashem. Now, Shuvo is the literal meaning of Shuvo. Shuvo means what? Return. So Rashi says, well, not exactly, which means there is a secondary meaning to the word shuvo. The word shuvo is many times related to the word calming down, shuvo vonachas. There is many places the word shuvo vonachas means like Shabbos, that your soul returns to its original place. You find your place again where it's supposed to be. So Rashi learns the shuvo means mirgoa, which means a very deep inner calmness. That's Mirgoya. Shuvo Hashem. Of course, that doesn't mean it doesn't make any sense. What do you mean, Shuvo Hashem? Calm down, God. What does it mean, according to Rashi?
You just dropped the top off of Shabbos and decided to Shuvo?
What?
You just dropped the top off of Shabbos?
Of course, Shabbos means Shuvo, which means return to the original source. The way Sfatem says, the idea of Shabbos is to return where you belong. That's why Shabbos is the letters of Shuvo. What does it mean, Shuv Hashem? And Rivevois Alpha Israel? That doesn't make any sense at all. Because Rivevois Alpha Israel means what? 22,000 Jews. So how do you put it together? And when the ark would rest, he would say, return God or calm down God? 22,000 Jews. It just doesn't fit together. It just doesn't make any sense. So, there is no question once you hear Reb Chaim Volozhiner, if Vayipin Soya Horoin means Golus, so what does Ubenucho Yoimar mean? Geula, no question about it. I mean, that's the follow up. Golus and Geula are mentioned over here, right? So Ubenucho Yoimar means that the coming, that the resting of the Oroin is a symbol of the final Geula. Shuvo Hashem, which means two things, return, Shuvo Loshen Shuvo, and Loshen calmness, that all the tensions of the Golus will disappear. So what does the 22,000 Jews mean? So Rashi says, 22,000 Jews, magid she'ein ha-shchino shuro, the shchino doesn't rest among the Jews if there aren't 22,000 people. That's fine, but there has to be a meaning to it, right? 22,000 people.
What's Levi'im?
Oh, so many portions. Say because the Levi'im had 22,000 people, so this is why it becomes the minimum amount of people in a city. But there is something else related to the way 22,000 is described in Hebrew. How do you say 22,000 in Hebrew? Rivevois Alfei. Now, you know that in Loshon Kodesh, the highest number is 10,000. There is no number higher than 10,000. Meaning, if you want to say 100,000, you say 10,000. You want to describe a million? 110,000. You want to describe 600,000? 60,000. 60 ribui. 10,000 is the highest. The word revovo or ribui is related to what word?
Inclusion.
What? Row. Masses. The masses. You know, the 10,000 is the numerical symbol for masses. Okay? What is the word for thousands? Elef. Now, it's unavoidable, the connection between Elef and what else? Elef. How do you spell Elef? No question, it has to do with Aleph, which is learning, Yalfinon Aleph, which is learning, and there's no question it's related to the number, to the letter Aleph. There's no question, it's no coincidence. Aleph Lamed Pei should mean Aleph, and it shouldn't be related with Aleph. So somehow the combination of Aleph and Revovo is the combination, they are opposite ideas if you pay attention. Aleph is a unique letter, the number one, the one that's alone, the unique, separated letter. Aleph represents, of course it's a large number, but in large numbers you have Alofim and you have Revovois, which means you have Aleph's luminaries, special people, right? Like somebody described, like the windows of the building, and then you have the bricks of the building. Right. Revovo represents the masses of the Jewish people. The Elefs represent the Alefs, the teachers of the Jewish people, the instructors, the learners, the unique people, the singular people, the individuals. Okay? There's no question about it that Elef is related with Alef, which is teaching, with the letter Aleph, which is the unique person, the influencer, the teacher, the luminary, the singular person. And Revovo is the number that represents the masses, the simple masses. What?
Let it say 11 calories.
What do you mean?
Let it say 11 calories. You want to have, so you're having, like all of Klal Yisrael represented here by
Revovo, right? You see.
You want to have the masses, right, in the individual, the 10,000 and the 1,000.
Right.
So
in other words, the repetition, in other words, the fact that there are two of them represents the multiplication of them. Not one mass, but the masses of the Jews. So what is the hidden meaning? Not the simple meaning where River Boy Salfe means 22,000. What is the hidden meaning behind the meaning of the words? When will the Oroin rest? When the Revovois will meet the Alofin. That's what it says, right? When will the Beis Hamikdash finally be rebuilt? When the thousands, the Alofim, the Elefs, the learners, will meet the Ribui, the masses, the Revovo. What is it that hint to? What?
Learning.
But learning and the joining of the elephs to the rebovos, which is what the Gemara says is what's missing for the third Beis HaMikdash to be rebuilt. What is the reason for the destruction of the second Beis HaMikdash? Sinasimu, the separation. Right? The separation. The unification is the final step of the Uvenucha Yomar. Okay? So, in this posuk then, in this tuksukim, you have the essence of Jewish history. Right? Golus and the rectification of Geulus. Golus and Geulo. That represents the essence of the Jewish people.
From one noon to the other noon.
From one noon to the other noon. That's it. That is the whole of Klal Yisrael. That's the history of Klal Yisrael in a nutshell. This is why it's a sefer b'fnei atzmo. And the Gemara says, this is why it says like a Megillah that has 58 letters. Or 85, I think 85, I don't remember anymore. If you count the letters, it's either 85, I think 85. Or maybe 58, I don't remember. It's the amount of letters that this Tupsukim have represent the minimal amount of a sefer. Because you know there are certain laws, like a Megillah, Mitame Sayodaim, certain laws. What is the minimal size of a sefer? The size of this parsha. Okay? Because this parsha is the essence of everything. Now, let's go on to the next piece. Vayhi ha'om kemisonenim. Somehow the Jews became complainers. Not the real Jews, but the Am. Who is the Am, says Rashi? Whenever it says Am, it means the ones that are not the mainstream of Jewish, the ones that follow the mainstream of the Jewish tradition. Right? It's like the Arab Rav, right? Then it goes on to say Pasuk Dalet. Well, let's just skip just to make get a mental. Ve'asafsuf asher bekir boy, in the Erev Rav, itavu tavo, they desired a desire. So the Mishnah Chochmo comments here. What does it mean to desire a desire, to lust a lust? What does it mean? So let me add to other things, and then we'll come back to the meaning of itavu tavo. What do they want? And then they influence Jews to start complaining. We want real food. Mi yachileinu boser. Who is going to give us real food? We want meat. We want meat. They want meat. In other words, what don't they want? Mat. They don't want mat. And then they say, Pasuk ei zocharnu es hadog v'asher no yichal b'mitzrayim chinom. We remember the fish that we ate for free. Right? So Rashi says, for free? Nothing in Mitzrayim was for free. Nothing was for free, says Rashi. What do you mean that for free? Well, no, says Rashi. It means chinom min hamitzvos. That's what Rashi says. Chinom min hamitzvos. Again, difficult. What do you mean chinom min hamitzvos? What is it? Well, we remember that we ate fish chinom min hamitzvos. So again, the Mishnah Chochmah says a beautiful pshat. He says, you see, they just asked for meat, right? But they know that it's such a problem eating meat. You have to slaughter it in the right way, and you have to prepare the knife in the right way, and then you have to salt it, and then you have to take off the this part of the meat you're not allowed to eat, this part of the fat you're not allowed to eat. So many problems. What is something alive that once you're allowed to eat it, you're allowed to eat everything. You don't have to worry about slaughtering blood, fat, fish. So that's what Rashi means. Zohan Wesadogo, we remember fish. You don't have to worry about slaughtering fish. You don't worry about the blood of the fish, the fat of the fish. We want to eat meat, but we want to eat it in an easy way, like fish. That's what it means, chinomina mitzvah. That's how the Mishnah Chochmah learns. Anyway, you know, there are other misfortunes that say, you know, it's very odd that they, you know, that their nostalgia for Egypt, very odd, and they forgot already what Egypt was like. So, you know, many people make the connection between this and the Gemara that says that the last 6 months of their stay in Egypt, they didn't have to work. You know that the Gemara says that the last 6 months, from Rosh Hashanah till Pesach, they didn't have to work. So somehow, you know, the memory is so selective, they forgot the past. They only remember the last 6 months. They said, well, that month, you know, who used to feed them? The state. Paro used to give them food, and they didn't have to work. So that's what they remember. Right. Anyway, they don't like the man. They don't like the man in Pasuk Vov. Vato nafshenu iveisho. Ain't kol. It's nothing. Ain't kol. Very odd expression. Ain't kol. There is nothing there. So many Mefarshim see in it the hint to what the Gemara says, you know, that the man was something that didn't go through the digestive system. It was absorbed by the body. There was nothing left. You didn't have to go to the washroom after eating man. So ein kol means there is nothing there. You eat it and eat it, right? And nothing left. So it's ein kol. So now they are complaining. You know, they didn't like the fact. We want to eat normal food like everybody else. Meaning they don't like man. Comes the Torah and starts describing how tremendous, how fabulous the man is. This is a little bit difficult to go into, but in Posuk Zion and Ches, the Torah describes that man is tremendous. Now, because what they were lying, the Jews were lying. They were saying man is terrible, and the Torah says man is fantastic. So who is right? Says the Gemara. Gemara in Bava Basra says like this: man for the tzaddikim was this. For the Beinoni, states. For the Rishonim, it was terrible.
No anymore.
Bava Basra, which where in Bava Basra? First verse in Bava Basra. So, what kind of a thing is it that the taste? I mean, it either tastes good or doesn't taste good. What does it mean? Yeah. So, let me tell you the principle, the idea behind it. I saw it in different places. I saw it in the Al-Sheikh. Al-Sheikh is a very early commentary. And I see the same idea in the Meshech Chokhma, but in a very short, in only as pshat in Hitavu Tavo, but the idea is exactly the same. Yeah.
I thought it was supposed to taste like anything that you wanted.
Okay. Meaning, if you love chocolate, so it tastes exactly like chocolate. Now, in reality, of course, we are talking in allegories. When we're saying, you know, it tasted like chocolate. If you love chocolate, it tastes like chocolate. It reminds us of how the Rambam describes the limitations of our language. It says, for instance, how do you describe something beautiful to a person who was born blind? Someone was born blind, right? Try to describe a beautiful picture or a beautiful sunset. How do you describe it? So you use something that he understands, right? So you say food. You say, the sunset is so beautiful like the piece of chocolate that you're eating. So is there a comparison? Or he listens to music. He loves the symphony. He says, the sunset that I'm looking at is like the symphony. Does it really mean that the symphony, the sounds of the symphony, describe the sunset? Of course not. We are borrowing language in order to understand it. In other words, for us, eating chocolate would be such a fantastic experience that the tzaddik, eating man, right, we can describe it in the same way, but we don't actually mean that you taste the chocolate. Says the Al-Sheikh like this: the nature of the man is a spiritual experience. Now, we don't know what it means. How can eating be a spiritual experience? A physical experience. Man was an actual spiritual experience. It was spiritual food, which means it was something physical. You put it into your mouth, but it wasn't the normal reaction of your taste buds. It was your neshama that reacted. Meaning, the taste buds of the neshama tasted the man, and if your neshama was well developed, right, then it tasted fantastically. Meaning, for instance, you can compare it to, for instance, five people listen to music. To some, it can be the most wonderful experience. This another person listening to the same sound can hear it as noise. How can it be? How can the same physical thing cause different reactions? Because it depends on your preparation. Did you develop the sensitivity to the music? So now the same thing with your soul. If you develop sensitivity to mon, you found it absolutely fabulous, the taste of the man. If you are not ready for it, it was boring, it was terrible, it had no taste. It all depended on your spiritual level. The same thing as learning Torah. Is learning Torah pleasurable or not? If you are ready for it, there can't be anything more pleasurable. If you are not, it's the most boring thing in the world. How can it be the same experience? Can it be terrible for one and delicious for somebody else? Yes, depends on your level. Right. As a matter of fact, eating mon was just the same experience as learning Torah. Meaning, those people who were able to appreciate Torah appreciated the money. As a matter of fact, what does the Gemara say? Through whose merit did we get money? Now, who gave us money? You know that we got in the Midbar, the Anane Kobold, right? That defended us. Who was that from? Aaron HaKohen. Anane Kobold, Aaron HaKohen. We had water that your company does in the desert? Miriam. And we had man. Who was man? No, Moshe Rabbeinu. Says Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu died. No more man fell. The end one from before that, yeah. Moshe Rabbeinu is the Mashpia Haman. He gave us man. Okay?
Did you say Arnos?
What? For the clouds. The clouds.
The clouds?
The clouds came from Aaron. When Aaron died, what happened? We were attacked because the clouds all of a sudden disappeared. Now, in the eating of the man, and appreciating and loving the man, right? There is a sign that you love Moshe Rabbeinu's teachings, right? By the rejection of the man, it's not only that you are rejecting the man, you are rejecting Moshe Rabbeinu as a teacher. You hear that? Now, with this introduction, right? I mean, let me just add what the Meshe Chochmo says. It says like this. Somehow, he says, when you eat meat, right, you develop your physical part of you, right, of yourself, right? You develop your desire. Meaning, the more meat you eat, the more physical you become, the more your desire for material things develop in you. The more man you ate, little by little, you lose the desire for physical things. So as a matter of fact, the Jews at this point didn't really desire meat because they were eating more for a while, and that caused for the desire for meat to diminish. But they were bothered by it. They wanted to develop the desire for meat. You hear this? So listen to the new insight into the words Vehoasafsuf Hitavu Tavo. What does it mean? Hitavu Tavo. They desired a desire. They didn't really desire meat. They desired to desire meat. Like they were missing the feeling of how it feels to desire meat. You hear how the Meshe Chochmo goes? Pasuk Dalet. They lusted the lust. Not that they lusted meat. They, at this point, they didn't even like meat. But it bothered me. Why am I not enjoying life, right? I lost my enjoyment for life, right? So they lusted for lust. That's how the Meshe Chochmo learns. Why? Because the man does not develop physical quality. He develops spiritual quality. So they wanted me. They wanted to develop their lust. So now, with this introduction, we can understand Moshe Rabbeinu's reaction to what the Jews want. Take a look. How Moshe Rabbeinu reacts. The Jews want meat, they don't want man. How does Moshe Rabbeinu react? Pasuk Yudalet. Vayomer Moshe l'Hashem, lo moyahare yoso le'avdecho, v'lo molamot losichem be'inecho. Why didn't I find favor in your eyes? Lo sum es maso kolom hazeh olai. I should take the burden on my shoulders of these people. Ho'onoichi horisies kolom hazeh. Did I carry these Jews in my womb? Did I give birth to the Jews? What kind of an argument is that? Did I give birth to the Jews? What does that have to do with anything? Etc. May I libo, sir? Where should I get meat? Impossible. What do you mean, where should I get meat? You're expected to give meat? God will give the meat. What does it mean, may I libo, sir? Do I have meat to give them? The truth of the matter here is that what's going on is that Moshe Rabbeinu is expressing the essential difference between being Moshe Rabbeinu. You know, we call Avram Avinu and we call Moshe Rabbeinu. What is this essential difference between Avinu and Rabbeinu? You see, Avinu, no matter what happens, you remain Avinu. if your child does whatever he wants, right, he remains your child, whether you want to or not. You don't, can't divorce your child. Ovinu is eternal. Rabbeinu is conditional. True? You can only remain a teacher if the other person is your disciple. The moment he ceases to be your disciple, you're not a teacher anymore. True? The moment the gap is too wide, he ceases to be the teacher and you cease to be the disciple. Okay? So what does Moshe Rabbeinu say? Did I give birth to them? What it means? If I would be their father like Avraham Avinu, then even if they reject me, even if the gap, I'm still stuck with them being Rabbeinu. But I didn't give birth to them. I'm only their Rabbeinu, I'm not their Avinu. So therefore, the moment they choose to reject me, I cease to be their leader. You hear the pshat? Did I give birth to them? Am I their Avinu? I'm their Rabbeinu. Rabbeinu is conditional. They are rejecting the man, they are rejecting me. And now we can understand the next piece. So how does Hashem react? Hashem says, okay, choose a Sanhedrin. Pasuk Tezayin. Vayomer Hashem el Moshe, Es for li shivim ish mezikne Yisrael, choose a Sanhedrin, and the Sanhedrin will take care of the needs of Klal Yisrael. What does a Sanhedrin have to do with a man? The Jews want the meat, and Hashem says to Moshe, okay, make a Sanhedrin. Because the real issue is not the man. The real issue is the rejection of Moshe Rabbeinu as their leader. The gap between the Jews and Moshe Rabbeinu became too wide, and the gap has to be filled. The gap is filled through the Sanhedrin, through the Shivim Ish. And this is what it means. Mayayin libosor. I can't give them meat. I can give them man. Man is a spiritual food. I'm their spiritual leader. I can't give them bosor. Bosor requires a physical leader. I'm not their physical leader. I'm their spiritual leader. This is what it means. Mayayin libosor. I can't give them meat. Right? I can give them man, but I can't give them meat. Okay? Now, with this insight, we can understand a very difficult portion that comes up right afterwards. Yeah. Listen to this. The Jews decide, Hashem tells the Jews to choose a Sanhedrin. How do they do it? By choosing the same amount of people as candidates for the Sanhedrin. But it doesn't work out. There are 12 tribes. How many people does every tribe have to choose in order to come up to 70? If they would choose 5, it's too few. If they would choose 6, it's 2 more than they need. 70. Moshe Rabbeinu still remains the original. 70. 2 more than they need. So it's 2 more than they need.
Why do they need 70?
Hashem asked for 70. That's for 70. That's the idea that represents the totality in the world. Shivim represents the totality of something. The physical totality is always the number 70. Shivim Loshen, the Jews, when they came to Egypt, there were 70 Jews. You know, the establishment of something physically is always with 70. So what did they do? So each tribe chose 6. So how many were they? 72. And then they drew lots to see who is out. Who is out of the Sanhedrin? Okay. So what happened in the meantime? In the meantime, the 72 people gathered, and the moment they gathered, being prepared to be chosen among the 72, 70 for the Sanhedrin, they had a very intense prophetic experience. And this is in Pasuk 25. Vayered Hashem be'onon, vaydaber elo, vayotzel min horuach asher elo. They actually had an experience similar to Moshe Rabbeinu's. Vayten al shivimish, right? Vayisnabu v'lo yosofu. But 2 out of the 70 were left aside. But they continued their prophetic experience. Vayishoaru, in Pasuk 26, Vayishoaru shnei anoshim b'machaneh. 2 people remained. Which 2 people? The 2 that lost out. Who were, right? This is how Rashi learns. Who were they? Eldad u'Medad. These 2 people, Eldad u'Medad, but their prophecy made an impact. What was the prophecy they were saying? The Torah doesn't say. The Torah hints it was something very upsetting for Yoshua bin Nun. So we hear from the oral tradition that what they prophesied was, Moshe Meis Yoshua Machnis. Moshe will die. Moshe will not bring the Jewish people into Israel. Yoshua will. Yoshua gets all upset. Moshe is calm. Don't worry about what's wrong. So let everybody prophesy. And he's not upset by it. As if for him it doesn't come as a surprise. Now, what's the meaning? What is the meaning in the timing? That now all of a sudden the prophecy comes down to earth that Moshe is not bringing the Jews into Israel. How is the timing connected with the whole story? Exactly. Moshe ceases to be, right, the leader of the Jewish people. The gap is too wide. Once the gap is too wide, Moshe can't bring the Jewish people into Israel. For Moshe to bring in the Jewish people into Israel, they have to be his close disciples. Because originally, for Moshe to bring the Jews into Israel, like the Chazal say, coming into Israel would have been such an experience, the same as leaving Egypt, with miracles, supernatural miracles. Only Moshe with very close disciples to be able to do it. When the gap widened, Moshe ceased to be the natural leader of the Jewish people. This is when the Nevuah comes down to earth. It's closely connected to the story before.
How did they get so separated?
How did they get separated? It wasn't all at once. It was a slow process, but it became widened and widened and widened. The rejection of the man, that's the final step.
What are some of the earlier steps?
The earlier steps, right from the beginning. From the beginning, when the Jews left Egypt, and 6 days later, they are pursued by Pharaoh, they complain to Moshe, why couldn't we stay in Egypt already? They cross the Red Sea, they come out of the Red Sea, they start complaining, they have no water, what they're going to drink, they're going to die, why can't they go back to Egypt? Right away, Mount Sinai. That was an experience that overcame all the past. But immediately after Mount Sinai, the sigh of relief, right, that was their experience right after Sinai was already a crack, right? And what about 40 days later, the golden calf? I mean, little by little, that gap is widened. But the rejection of the man is a direct rejection of the leadership of Moshe Rabbeinu.
Since he was never...
Yeah. What?
Can I understand?
Yeah, sure.
Since he was never really a prophet.
Who?
Moshe
Rabbeinu. Well, ideally he was a prophet. Of course he was. Klal Yisrael never kept up with his level. Right.
Yeah, but it seems they never really were.
Well, obviously that there was a chance, otherwise he wouldn't have been chosen. He was chosen because there was a chance. And at the moment of Kabbalah Satorah, there was that closeness that made him the disciples of Moshe Rabbeinu, and that's why we call him Moshe Rabbeinu, because of Har Sinai. Right?
How does the quantity count to the two left out of the lot?
The truth of the matter is we don't know that they did not, but when they got together to form the Sanhedrin, they remained with their previous experience and they expressed what the prophecy was. It doesn't say that they did not prophesy. They also prophesied, but the information came through them. Because they weren't busy with the Sanhedrin, the information came from them. It doesn't say that they did not have the prophecy, just the opposite. It sounds like they all had the same prophecy.
Why did they prophesy though if they weren't part of the Sanhedrin?
No, when they gathered with the purpose that each one of them could potentially be the Sanhedrin.
So they went back and they had the prophecy while they were in the group and they went back.
Exactly, that's what it says. They had the prophecy before, then the two were left out, but they continued speaking about their experience. Right?
So what's that do that the camp before I have to come in London?
Again?
It says in the Na'ar, right?
Yeah, you know, the Na'ar is Yoshua ben Nun. Right?
Yes.
It says, well, there is later on it's mentioned Yoshua ben Nun. There's one shift in the Medrash that says the Na'ar is Yoshua ben Nun. Some say Gershon, but in other words, it was somebody important that came to tell Moshe Rabbeinu about what Eldo du Medrash are saying. Now, there is another story at the end of the Parsha that on the surface is completely unrelated to everything we've been saying, and on the surface it makes no sense what it's doing here. Secondly, the whole story doesn't make any sense, and that's the story in chapter 12. Vatedaber Miriam ve'Aaron b'Moshe. All of a sudden, Miriam and Aaron start talking Lashon Hora against Moshe Rabbeinu. Why? because Aloidoiso Isho Akush is concerning the Kushis, according to Rashi, means the beautiful woman, because everybody knew that Tzipora was a beautiful woman. So they, she was known as the Kushis. For some reason, that expressed beauty. So, what did they say about her? So, first of all, in the story itself, makes no sense at all. And they said, Kisho Kushis Lokoch, and then they said, and what? Vayoimru Harakav Ben Moshe Dibur Hashem. Is Moshe the only prophet? We are also prophets. What is the connection between that and Isho Akushi? It doesn't make any sense at all. But even the oral tradition doesn't add much to the understanding of the parsha. It says that what they were saying was that Tzipora had made a remark to Miriam that all these people, the Nevi'im, they also are going to separate themselves from their wives like Moshe Rabbeinu separated from me. Hear the remark. A remark that told Miriam in an indirect way that Moshe and Tzipora had no marital relations. And this was a fact. As a matter of fact, from after Sinai onwards, Moshe Rabbeinu had no marital relations. This came as a shock to Miriam. Why? Because they never heard about the halacha that a novi is not allowed to have marital relations. Never heard that halacha. So according to the oral tradition, this was the Lashon Hara against Moshe Rabbeinu. Why is it that he does things that he doesn't have to, so he causes unnecessary suffering to Tzipora? So that's the Lashon Hara. So what's the meaning of it? Why did they say it? What's the meaning of it? That we don't know the meaning. What does Hashem tell them? So Hashem comes down and speaks to them and tells them, no, you are making a big mistake, Miriam and Aaron. You think that the difference, everybody knew that Moshe Rabbeinu is the greatest prophet, right? They admit it. And nobody doubted that Moshe Rabbeinu is a greater prophet than Miriam and Aaron. Except that they thought that the difference is a quantitative difference. He's bigger, greater. So Hashem tells them, no, the difference is qualitative. Why? Because, impossible. My prophecy to you is always in a state of unconsciousness, which means a prophet can't have consciousness and at the same time have a prophecy. You have to lose your awareness of your body before you can have the awareness of Hashem's presence. Therefore, every prophet had prophecy only in a state of unconsciousness. Do you hear that? Moshe Rabbeinu was different. He was qualitatively different. He had prophecy while he was completely conscious. So therefore, you are making a great mistake. You are comparing Moshe to you, and it's two different things. Moshe is a unique person. He's not a regular prophet. So how can you compare yourself to him? Yeah.
Sounds like Tzipora was complaining. She says, woe unto the wives of these men.
Right. I mean, she made a remark. I mean, you know, women talk. So she meant it as, they have to let to adjust. Well, she was complaining.
She didn't sound happy about it.
It was a sacrifice. I mean, for Tzipora, it was definitely a sacrifice. Nobody doubted it for Tzipora. Who? Tzipora to Miriam,
yes.
Concerning the prophets, that they are going to be separated from their wives like Moshe separated from me.
I don't understand how this ties in with him having to not having to be conscious of that.
How does marriage, the prohibition of marital relations? So the point is like this: there is a prophet is really two people in one. He's a normal human being while he's conscious, and he becomes a prophet when he's unconscious. So therefore, as long as he's conscious, right, he can have normal marital relations, which means because his body, right, is not a prophetic body, so to speak.
So it wasn't true, they said.
It wasn't true. Meaning they made a mistake. They made a mistake about the quality of Moshe Rabbeinu's prophecy. Their mistake was that they thought that Moshe Rabbeinu's superiority is a quantitative superiority when it was really a qualitative superiority. That's really what the passage is telling you. But what's the point and what's the connection with the story before? So let me tell you, we don't have much time, but let me just tell you the story, the main point. Why didn't Miriam do it? I mean, obviously Miriam wasn't trying to really criticize Moshe Rabbeinu. There was something else behind it, you see? What are we saying that's going on right now? The gap between Moshe Rabbeinu and the Jews is widening. Right? Meaning, in order to remain a Rabbeinu, there has to be a gap. Because if there is no gap, then you can be a teacher. But if the gap is too wide, again, you can't be a teacher. There has to be a certain balance between the teacher and the disciple in order to maintain.
What?
There are two ways that you can close the gap. One way is to raise the level of the Jewish people and close the gap a little bit. If that doesn't work, there is another way. To talk down the level of Moshe Rabbeinu. Maybe if he's able to come down from his level and still remain Moshe Rabbeinu, maybe that will itself close the gap. It was like a desperate attempt to close the gap between Moshe Rabbeinu and the Jewish people. This is how it's connected to the whole parsha before. The rejection of the man is the widening of the gap. This establishment of the Sanhedrin. The Nebuah that said Moshe can't lead the Jews into Israel. The gap is too wide. She is desperate to get back the relationship between Moshe Rabbeinu and the Jewish people. Let him be the leader. Even if it requires coming down from his level. This is the meaning behind the Lashon Hara of Miriam. She wanted Moshe Rabbeinu to come down. And Hashem says that's impossible. The essence of Moshe Rabbeinu is he is whatever he is. That is out of the question. The only choice is either Klal Yisrael does go up to his level, or does go up enough to close the gap, or it doesn't. But Moshe Rabbeinu will never come down. Don't forget that whenever we talk about punishment of a great, great person, there are different standards, which means at her level, right, this is not how Miriam should have done it, which means at any other level, such an attempt would be considered a tremendous idea, right? For Miriam and Aaron, at their level, that was considered a mistake. But you can't see in it something which is purely wrong. Obviously, when they did it with the best intention. And on the surface, it's difficult to understand what was their intention. So you can say, maybe to help Tzipora, but that wouldn't have become such a major issue in the Torah. And the timing of it, and the placing of this story right after the story of the rejection of the man and of the prophecy that Moshe can bring the Jews into Israel, it only fits if we understand it in those terms. Miriam is trying to close the gap. She's trying to bring down Moshe Rabbeinu in order for the Jews to be able to be led by Moshe Rabbeinu again. Very possible. Very possible.
Why make it so hard?